We're studying in the 10th chapter of Deuteronomy, and in the first part of this chapter, he relates the great and good things God had done for his people after they had broken his covenant, built the golden calf, and then God had decided that he would forgive the people. Then he did these things. We learn that he gave them his law again in the first part of this 10th chapter of Deuteronomy. He led them toward Canaan. He appointed the Levitical tribe to be the special ministers, including the priesthood. And he gives Moses as their leader and intercessor. Now, we've gotten down to the 13th verse, and I'd like to begin reading with the 12th verse. And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee, but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day for thy good. So the question is asked now, what does God require of thee? He's done these things for you. He's given you the law again. He's led you towards Canaan. He's given you the Levitical priesthood. Moses is your mediator. Now, what do you do? And of course, as we mentioned last time, we need to each ask ourselves this same question. There are certain things that God does in his promises and in his dealings with us. God does his part. But then the question is asked, what about our part? What does God expect us to do? Do we have any duties to do? And certainly we do. And it just seems to be a great human failing that we invariably look to God to do his part, to give his part of the blessings, to carry out his part of the covenant and the agreement, to keep on letting us make plans regarding his promises, but yet we forget that we owe equally a duty to God. And here he briefly comprehends it by saying, but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day for thy good. So, to love him, to fear him, to serve him, to keep his commandments. That's the duty of Israel. That's what Israel is to do in return now. And so the rest of this chapter is devoted then to specifically relating the things that Israel is to do and to give the reasons that they're to do them, to give the qualities that God has that then would require Israel or inspire Israel to carry out these duties. So in verse 14, behold, the heaven and the heaven of heavens is the Lord's thy God, the earth also with all that therein is. So he first of all inspires Israel by telling them how valuable God is, how many possessions God has. Well, what are the possessions of God? Just how rich is God? Well, he says, the heaven and the heaven of heavens is the Lord's thy God, the earth also with all that therein is. Now, this is almost beyond our comprehension. To think of the earth and everything that's in the earth, all of the riches, all of the mineral and the ore, everything that's in the sea, everything that has ever been built on this earth that has any value, all of the minerals, all of the life, including the plant life and the animal life, everything pertaining to the earth belongs to God, plus all of the heavens. The stars, the sun, the moon, all of the planets, all of the galaxies, everything we can comprehend belong to the Lord. And all of the heavenly beings, all of the laws of the universe, he owns all of them. So when we stop and see how rich God is, how many possessions God has, then we ask the question, what's he doing being so mindful of man? Why is man then able to take up so much of God's time and so much of God's energy? Surely then, if God with all these possessions can stoop so low as to give us the time and the effort that he does, surely then we owe God something. We should be putting a considerable amount of our time and our energy and our effort toward God because of all of the tremendous amount of wealth that he has that he's really put at our disposal. It seems as he's created all of these things to kind of revolve around man, if we could be so conceited as to think that. And if that be true, then look at what we owe to God. Because God really, when he get right down to it, he really doesn't need any one of us. He can get along quite well without us. And it's only because of his love, then, that he has this concern for us. And so in verse 15, only the Lord had a delight in the fathers, in thy fathers to love them. And he chose their seed after them, even you, above all people, as it is this day. Now you'd think God would have so much to occupy him, so many things that would take his time and his efforts and his energies, that he wouldn't even have time for man. But with all of these things that God possesses, he says, only the Lord had a delight in thy fathers to love them. The Lord had a delight in thy fathers. He loves thy fathers. Talking about, of course, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the patriarchs, to love them. And he chose their seed after them, even you, above all people, as it is this day. So when you put it in that perspective, here God with all these riches and all these possessions and all these interests that he could have, he's chosen you above all people. Even this day. So, after having said that, then, the people ought to be very receptive as to any duty he should enjoin upon them to do. What's God going to say to do now? He's made a good case for the obedience that we owe to God. A real good case. Now, what does he say to do? Well, the first thing he says is, circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart and be no more stiff-necked. Now this phrase, to circumcise the foreskin of your heart, is an allusion to circumcision, the rite that was practiced by the Jews. And what he really is saying here is to cut away or to do away with, to eliminate those things in your life that are useless to the service of God. All of the sin, all of the enmity and the wrath and the envy and jealousies and the hatred that would come between you and God and doing your duty to God, eliminate this. Circumcise, he says, the foreskin of your heart. And your heart is that inner part of you. It has to do with your inner being and even your mind. Free your mind from all the encumbrances that are getting in the way of service to God. And of course, there's no end to what you could say here about naming individual specific items that this could refer to, but we're trying to get the principle over right now. Circumcise your heart. Not enough to have just to be circumcised in the flesh, but he says circumcise the foreskin of your heart to get rid of these problems that would interfere between you and God. And then he says, and be no more stiff-necked. Now, to be stiff-necked is an allusion to an oxen that refuses to yield to the yoke. He has a stiff neck. He will not submit to the yoke. He will not work in the yoke as a team should. But he's stubborn. He is obstinate. He is rebellious. And so the people then are compared to that when they're said to be stiff-necked. So we're to be submissive to God's will. Submit ourselves to God. Yield with whatever the command of God is. So these two things then, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be no more stiff-necked. two very, very important principles that not only apply then, but they also apply to us today. We today must be willing to do this great principle, as mentioned in verse 16, or we're not going to be able to serve God. Then in verse 17, "For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, a great God, a mighty, a terrible, which regardeth not persons, nor taketh reward." Now in earlier he showed, in verse 14, how rich God was, all the possessions that he has. Now he shows what power God has, what a high position of glory and might that he occupies. He is God of gods and Lord of lords, a great God. There is no God that can be named or that can be imagined, that can be worshipped or that can be known that this God is not God over. Any power, any institution, any organization, nothing equals this God. He is God of gods. He's Lord of lords. A great God. A mighty. A terrible. Which regardeth not persons nor taketh reward. You can't bribe him. You can't buy him off. You can't make him change his mind or his judgment by offering him reward. He doesn't regard persons. That is, he is an impartial God in that sense. And so, as we realize this great principle today, we realize that there is no institution that is not subservient to God. God is the sovereign power. All other powers are delegated powers. That's the kind of a God we serve. Now, realizing that, realizing the true greatness of God, that when we look around for value, when we look around for power, when we look around for might, there's not any other to be found that equals him. How can we possibly pass him by? How can we possibly turn him down with our service? How can we find anything better to do with our time than to serve the great God? He says he is terrible. A terrible, a mighty, a great God, which regards not persons, nor taketh reward. Now, seeing his greatness, seeing his might, seeing his true position of honor, notice how this God manifests himself and how this God acts in verse 18. He doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and widow, and loveth the stranger in giving him food and raiment. Now he's leading up to really showing these Israelites some more of their duties here. But he says that this God, as mighty as he is, he doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and widow. James says pure religion and undefiled before God is to visit the fatherless and the widow in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world. You see, this is a principle that goes all the way through. God executes the judgment of the fatherless and the widow. Let's think about that just for a moment. It's very difficult for us to know how somebody else thinks if we're not in their position or if we haven't at one time been in their position. It's hard for us to have true empathy and true sympathy with somebody if we don't really know how they feel. He's talking about here how the fatherless, which is really talking about the orphans, and the widows, and I'm sure this also includes any great class of persons who are depressed, who have had their strength removed from them so that they really are not able to make any powerful moves or suggestions or actions. How do these people think? What goes on in their mind? Those that have poverty, those that are suppressed for whatever reason may be, how do they think? What are their desires? What are their wishes, their judgments about things? Well, this God, he doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and the widow. The things that they're needing and wanting and desiring, this great powerful God is willing to carry those things out. He executes their judgment. And sometimes we, in our haste, and in the little bit of wealth and affluence that we might have been allowed to acquire in this life, we overlook the feelings of the lesser persons. We maybe run roughshod over them, maybe not on purpose, maybe even through ignorance. But this great God, he takes notice of them because he executes their judgment, their thoughts, their desires, their needs. This God is willing to carry those things out. He's thinking about them. And so when we see he's the Lord of Lords, the God of Gods, the great, the mighty, the terrible, but yet he is executing the judgment of the widows and the orphans. And this then gives us a perspective on God. Even though he is so great, he also is able to have the feelings of the lowest and the most humble of people. And if we then are going to be godlike, if we're going to be godly, we too are going to have to learn to have these same feelings. And then the next thing he says, and loveth the stranger. Now God loves the stranger. And the most basic feeling, I guess, that humans have is to want to repel, to want to cast down, to want to isolate ourselves from strangers. We don't like to have too much to do with strangers. A stranger come through town, well, most of the people just kind of sit back and give him a look. He's really not wanted. He's not made to feel as though he is a part of the group at all. But the Bible says that he loveth the stranger in giving him food and raiment. God takes care of the stranger just like he takes care of us. We think that we get food and raiment because God only sees us. He does many of these same things for the stranger that he does for us. So he must have some care for the stranger or he wouldn't be giving him food and raiment. He lets him live. He gives him the same things on the earth that he gives us for the most part, even though we may not even know God. He loveth the stranger. And so he concludes by saying in verse 19, love ye therefore the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. You do the same thing, Israel. Love the stranger. Now this is one of God's principles, to love the stranger. And the reason is because ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. There was a time when you were strangers. And it seems in the history of God's people that there is a recurrent cycle of God's people being put into a position where they are strangers. Abraham began his journeys over in Ur of the Chaldees, and all of his days he was a stranger. He was a sojourner. Whenever God's people came into Canaan, and then they had to go down into Egypt, they were strangers there in Egypt. They were foreigners. They were really not, although they were there for some 400 years, they really were looked upon as outsiders, even to the point of becoming slaves. Their travels in the wilderness, their entrance into Canaan, they were the stranger. Finally carried into captivity, the stranger. When they came back from captivity, still strangers. Whenever the church was established and the disciples were scattered, preaching the gospel, they went into community with this new strange doctrine, they were strangers. Paul making his speech in the Areopagus there in Athens, they just came to hear some strange new thing that he had to say. So we can see then how that we occupy the position of strangers, and consequently we ought to have a special feeling for strangers. God loveth the stranger and giving them food and raiment. And he says, love ye therefore the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Now one of the odd things is, we may think this is not a very significant command here, But when it came down to the time for the church to be established, for the Savior to come to this earth, and for the gospel to be spread to the world, one of the main downfalls of the Jewish people was the fact that they were so repulsed by Gentiles. They looked upon the Gentiles as being a strange, peculiar people, and they didn't want the Gentiles to have anything to do with the things of God. And they refused to accept the Gentiles into their religious circle. And when it came down to the point that the gospel was preached to the Gentiles and the Gentiles received it, and the Jew began to see this, he wanted no part of it. Because it meant then that the Gentile could have salvation equal to him without having to carry out the works of the law. And this was too much for the Jew to stomach that. He just could not tolerate that at all. And so his refusal to love the stranger, which in that case was the Gentile, is one of the great downfalls in his ability to receive the gospel. Now, we today find ourselves maybe in a very similar position. If we have the truth, there may be coming a time in which a bulk of the Jewish people are going to receive the true gospel. And if that be true, then our position is going to be not to look upon them as some strange, odd person to be shunned and to be persecuted, but our position is going to be the same as theirs was, to love the stranger. For remember, ye were a stranger in Egypt. And there was a time when the Gentile was a stranger in the church. The church was originally open to the Jewish people, not to the Gentile. We don't have a record of a Gentile even having a sermon preached to him until about 10 years after the church was established. In Acts 10, with the case of Cornelius. And there may come a time when we're a stranger again. So his principle is, love the stranger. And you can see how this is leading up to the time when the gospel would be a universal religion open to all peoples everywhere in the world. And God didn't want one group to think they got a corner on God and nobody else can break into that society. Then in verse 20, thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, him shalt thou serve, and to him shalt thou cleave and swear by his name. Further giving our duties to God. Fear him, that is, have a reverential respect for him. Serve him, that is, give our bodies, our minds, our souls in his service. To him shalt thou cleave. We hold to him, we get as close to him as we can. We do not depend upon nor trust any other force in this world besides God. And swear by his name. His name is the one that we call upon. He's the one that we look to verify the truth. No other name. What a tremendous put down it is to God to take another name than the name of God. To use another name to verify a truth than to use the name of God. Verse 21, he is thy praise and he is thy God. Anytime we have any praise to give out, he is the praise. It's all directed somehow or other to the channel that flows toward God. Regardless of what our blessings are we able to make a good living with the work of our hands and the sweat of our brow? He is our praise. He is the cause of it. As we read in the previous chapter, or the earlier part of this chapter, he has given us the strength to get our riches with. It's not our doing, it's really God's doing. Do we have a comfortable place to live? Do we have adequate clothing? Do we have a family that we can be thankful for and that we can associate with? It all goes to God. He is our praise. We don't have any reason to praise anything else without ultimately having the praise directed to God. And he is thy God. There is no other God. That's the rule. That's the law. That's the basic doctrine. We had that a few lessons back. There is no other God. There is the one God. You serve Him with all your mind and heart and soul, all of your energies. There is no other God. That's the great command. The second one, of course, is like unto it, to love thy neighbor as thyself. The great Ten Commandments are divided into two parts. The first part, the first four, have to do with the one God and service to Him. The last six have to do with our service to man, our fellow man. All the law and all the commands hang upon this fact. Serve God and love your neighbor. He is thy praise. He is thy God that hath done for thee these great and terrible things which thine eyes have seen. And of course, this refers back to the many things that he's mentioned now in this chapter. Verse 22. Thy fathers went down into Egypt with 70 persons. Back when Jacob and his sons lived in Egypt, rather when they lived in Canaan and left Canaan, there was 70 persons, 70 persons. And now the Lord thy God hath made thee as the stars of heaven for multitude. He started with that 70 persons, and now your offspring, your nation has grown to the proportions of the multitude like the stars of the heavens. He's showing them what great things God has done for them. Now we're going to chapter 11 of Deuteronomy.